Hello, I'm Sami Zeidan. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, the war in Ukraine could severely impact the global economy, and the IMF also warns the consequences could be lasting. So, which countries are most at risk? And is the world heading into a new financial crisis? Also this week, cut off from the international financial system, Russia has turned to the Chinese yuan to survive sanctions. Could other governments shift away from the US dollar? And is the greenback dominance in danger? Cryptocurrency purchases in rubles have been rising, and governments are worried Russia could evade sanctions using virtual coins. So is unregulated money really a fix for Russia's financial woes? The war in Ukraine is obviously hurting the economies of Russia and its neighbor, with both countries expected to experience sharp recessions this year. But the economic consequences of the war will not only be felt by parties to the conflict. Sweeping sanctions imposed on Moscow and the soaring price of energy supplies, well, they could inflict pain on other nations too. That's all, of course, while the world economy is still recovering from that coronavirus pandemic. The International Monetary Fund says the war could have a severe impact on the global economy. It expects to cut its growth forecasts globally. The IMF has also reduced its estimated global growth rate for 2022 to 4.4% in January. That's down from 4.9% last year. The most serious threat to the world economy is soaring inflation, which is already at levels that haven't been seen in decades. Well, that's mainly driven by the sharp rise in commodities and food prices. Europe, with its heavy dependence on Russian energy, could be particularly hit. The Ukraine war is expected to reduce Eurozone economic growth by as much as 2 percentage points. Consumer prices in the 19 countries that use the Eurozone currency hit record highs for 4 months in a row, reaching 5.8% in February. While the US is also at risk, it is expected to outperform European countries. And the conflict is also putting a fresh strain on that overstretched global supply chain, pushing up the prices of many metals. Both Russia and Ukraine export large amounts of steel, palladium, platinum and nickel, among others. Some car makers have idled factories due to a lack of components. And it is poor and developing nations that could suffer the most. Among the challenges ahead are trade shocks, a reduction in remittances and financial instability. But food security could be the most imminent threat. Russia and Ukraine are both main exporters of wheat, and parts of Africa and the Middle East could suffer severe shortages. Well, to discuss all of this now, I'm joined from Newcastle in the UK by Klaus Vistessen. Klaus is the chief Eurozone economist with Pantheon Macroeconomics. Good to have you with us. So many experts now are comparing the current situation to the 1970s energy crisis, to the collapse of the Lehman Brothers. Do you see any of those similarities?
Well, I mean, if we're very unlucky, it could be a combination of both, right? Because you have the specter of a Russian default that could be like Lehman, and you certainly have the 1970s-style supply-side-driven inflation. I mean, at the moment, I would say we're more sort of towards the 1970s in the way that, you know, demand in the economy is strong, and then we've had pretty much since COVID hit, we've had a string of supply-side shocks in the economy. The war in Ukraine is now an additional supply-side shock. Russia is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, commodity exporter in the world. So,
but hang on. I mean, Klaus, you just said if we're unlucky, this could be both. That's huge. Are we on the verge of another major global financial crisis?
That's not our baseline, but certainly we are now dealing with events where things can get out of hand very quickly and where I think no one knows exactly what the ramifications will be, right? So a Russian sovereign default could obviously send other markets in a tailspin. We already have stressed financial markets, so we're certainly now in a rather precarious situation. Obviously, policy is being tightened, although, again, that could change. But at the moment, you know, policy support has been withdrawn because of high inflation. So We have a downside risk to growth. Inflation is very high, which constrains policymakers, at least in the near term. So yeah, no, certainly the risk of something adverse happening is certainly rising, I would say.
You mentioned inflation there, and the IMF is expected to reduce its forecasts. Are we heading towards the perfect scenario for stagflation?
Oh, we are in stagflation now, I think. I mean, if you look at forecasts in general over the last 3 months, and I would say this is going to continue for the next 3 months, also with reference to your comment now on the IMF, inflation forecast will be ratcheted up because as we economists start to factor in and quantify what the increase in commodity prices mean for inflation over the next sort of 6 months, if you will, inflation forecasts will have to go up, but growth forecasts will have to go down. So again, whether we're staring into a global recession, we don't think that. So of course, that's probably sort of mild stagflation, but insofar as goes, the idea that inflation is going up, but growth is slowing, and you know that's what's happening, and you know that is stagflation.
Wow, that's huge. What will that mean for less developed countries, for countries which are already struggling, Jordan, Lebanon, Tunisia? I mean, countries which subsidize the basics of life, like electricity prices and so on, how will they deal with this challenge?
Well, economies like that are in a very tight spot now because they will be hit very hard by the kind of inflation we're seeing now in food prices, basic commodities, whereas the developed economies are a little bit more shielded towards that, A, because they're richer, but also because their consumer price indices are not as sensitive towards these kinds of price increases. So I would say that, you know, the consequences of effectively, if you will, shutting the Russian economy, in this case, out of the global economy, and you know the ramifications that have on different commodity markets in an environment where commodities and inflation already was kind of hotting up, yeah, that could have quite significant consequences for some of the economies you mentioned there, who obviously, to a large extent, depend on imported goods in some food stuff. Of course, these economies also produce a lot of their own stuff. But again, some of them are still dependent on imports.
And what about China? China's growth forecasts are going down. Its costs, at least of energy, going up. How's this going to impact Xi Jinping's policies?
Well, I think for China, it's a sort of a balanced situation. Politically, of course, they will feel that the extent to which there's now a widening rift between, you know, the East and the West, they feel that they might will be able to become sort of a center point in the eastern part of this. So they will try, of course, to politically exploit that situation. But economically, yeah, I mean, Chinese growth is already under pressure. They have a huge issue in their property sector, which is affecting large parts of their economy at the moment. And so in that context, the fact that global growth now seems to be slowing in the context of an inflationary shock and withdrawal of support in general, that's certainly not a favor, certainly not a benefit for China. But generally, in terms of the sort of geopolitics, I think maybe, you know, China will feel that they have opportunities here to make a few points.
You mentioned developed countries a moment ago. Let's talk about Europe, the continent. Risking recession right now?
Yes, it is. I mean, that again, we don't think the Eurozone will fall in recession, but we've recently downgraded our forecast for the second half of the year, reflecting high inflation, a hit to real incomes, less monetary policy support. So certainly that's a risk. I mean, I would say that the upside in the Eurozone is that fiscal support, governments are after COVID in particular, where, of course, they've helped the economy a lot, I think they'll be quicker to rush to support economies here. You know, I think we will see direct subsidies for especially low-income households in the context of protecting them from higher energy prices. I think we'll see big investments front-loaded in defense spending, which also, you know, has a boost that also boosts GDP growth in the short term. We'll see big investments in energy infrastructure, which also could be front-loaded. So I think the private sector certainly now will probably have to grow at a slower pace because inflation simply is going to sap some of that momentum. But I think governments are going to try to offset that. Of course, that's just going to push even more on inflation. So in some sense, you know, if there's one thing I'm certain about is that inflation will continue to go higher. Everything else is sort of a little bit uncertain at this point.
What about the US? We can't not talk about the world's largest economy. How resilient is the US economy to all of this? Some say, well, it would take oil prices going north of $200 a barrel before the US is pulled into recession. What do you think?
Well, that's the good news. We think the US economy is relatively resilient to this. You know, consumers have lots of stored up savings. They're a little bit further away from the situation in Europe in general. So, yes, they will import, obviously, inflation via higher energy prices. But also remember, this is a really, really important point. The US economy is different now because the US economy has a big oil-producing sector itself via shale, which means that as oil prices go up, yes, it affects the US consumer negatively, but they have a lot of savings, but it also boosts energy capex. So this old story in which, you know, oil prices go up and that immediately hits US growth, it's not necessarily the same anymore. We think that, you know, there could be even be a positive correlation between high oil prices and capex investment and growth in the US, because you'll see oil production start to pick up. So the US is resilient. That's very good news for the global economy, because obviously that will become, I mean, if the US economy does well, you know, that already there means that the global economy is on a relatively decent footing, even if, you know, you have weakness elsewhere.
All right. Thanks so much. Been good talking to you.
Same. Thank you for talking.
Sanctions imposed by the West on Russia are reviving an old debate on whether countries should hold dollar-based central bank reserves. You see, the worry is they may lose access to those reserves when they need them the most if they run foul of the West. The Russian government has been at risk of defaulting on its debt, not because Moscow doesn't have the money. Actually, it does. But it can't access almost half its foreign reserves, which have been frozen by Western capitals. Russia says it's made $117 million in interest payments it owes to investors, but the money could be blocked by the US. The Russian finance ministry says the nation would try to pay in rubles if this happens. Moscow has a 30-day grace period in which the government should pay up. If it doesn't, that would constitute a default. It would be the first time the country fails to meet its financial obligations since the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. While Russian banks and firms are increasingly turning to China's currency, the yuan, as they face isolation from the West, lender VTB Bank is offering a Chinese currency savings account with a maximum interest rate of 8%. Others are also looking to start using China's UnionPay system for credit cards after Visa and MasterCard suspended operations in Russia. The dollar has been the world's reserve currency since the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944. Russia held $100 billion, or 16% of its foreign reserves in US dollars, as of June 2021. Another 32% was held in euros. And the country has been trying to reduce its holdings of US dollar-denominated assets in recent years. It sold off all of its US treasuries in 2018. Moscow also held over $120 billion worth of gold, more than its actual dollar-denominated holdings. The commodity is effectively its primary holding, given the loss of access to dollars and euros. The yuan is the world's fifth largest reserve currency. Central banks held at least $319 billion US dollars worth of yuan reserves in the third quarter of 2021. Some economists say there's an effort underway to build an alternative financial system to that dominated by the US. They say the yuan, together with gold and cryptocurrencies, are likely to gain market share at the expense of Western currencies. Well, to discuss this, I'm joined now by Timothy Ash. He's a senior emerging market sovereign strategist at Blue Bay Asset Management. He joins us now from London. Good to have you with us. So has the yuan become Russia's new dollar, or is it becoming Russia's new dollar?
I don't buy it. I think what's interesting about this crisis is the unwillingness of the Chinese to bankroll Russia and to kind of help the Russians circumvent sanctions. And we've seen that kind of across the board. I mean, you know, lots of criticism of sanctions from the West and their ineffectiveness. But actually, the financial sanctions that have been lobbied so far and the fact that energy has not really been sanctioned, it's quite incredible that companies just do not want to transact with Russia, including for energy, because of the financial sanctions. So bottom line is the dollar is still king.
All right. But regardless of how willing the Chinese are or are not, is distrust, global distrust growing in the US dollar? Because Russia is not the first country that's, you know, been deprived access to its assets. We've had Iran, North Korea, the Taliban, and so on.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, what's again notable is OFAC, the US Treasury and the Western sanctions machine, is just so so powerful that what this shows is you may find alternative ways to transact, but in the end, Western sanctions will find you. And all these companies, the Chinese banks, etc., they're desperate to avoid being caught in secondary sanctions. So even if there are these alternative payment mechanisms, you know, the OFAC will find you eventually and you will be hit by these secondary sanctions. So it doesn't really solve the underlying problem that you have an entity like Russia is sanctioned because of its bad behavior. OFAC is going after you and companies simply do not want to be caught in the firing line of OFAC.
Maybe we should focus a little bit now on the sanctions and just how unprecedented are the sanctions, not in Russia, but particularly on its reserves, its foreign currency reserves?
Well, pretty remarkable. I mean, you know, no one expected the CBR to be sanctioned, a central bank. It's kind of unheard of. You know, and it came so quickly. I mean, I remember the week, you know, that week there was a research paper, I think, on the Wednesday or Thursday highlighting that this was an option. There was intense discussions, I know, on the Saturday in Washington around it. And then it was done on the Sunday. I mean, utterly remarkable, but devastating for Russia. You know, Russia thought it was in this untouchable position with $640 billion of FX reserves. It could withstand anything the West threw at it. And then OFAC, you know, dropped the bombshell sanctioning the CBR reserves. And it put a huge weight of those reserves beyond their reach. They've got gold, I guess, in their vaults. They've got physical cash. There is obviously some swap lines with the Chinese, but even the Chinese, I think, are reluctant really to help them out very much. Again, this idea, you know, they don't want to be caught in secondary sanctions for helping out Russia. So, you know, it's put Russia in an incredibly difficult place on the brink of default. Their financial markets have totally collapsed. It's extraordinary. You know, 95% loss in value across the board, equities, bonds, and the currencies come under massive pressure. So Russians, because of these sanctions, are a lot poorer today than they were a month and a half ago because of Putin's actions. And notable, I think, there is they did not expect it. You know, the foreigners generally reduced exposure to Russia. The biggest holders of Russian assets are Russians themselves. They believe the rhetoric coming out of the Kremlin.
Let me jump in there, Timothy.
There's going to be no sanctions.
Say, despite that, despite the unprecedented nature of targeting a central bank, as you just explained for us, you don't agree with those analysts who say this could be a turning point, this could be the birth of a new monetary order?
I don't think so. You know, I mean, what are Russians dashing for? What does the guy in the street in Moscow want to get his hands on? He doesn't want to get his hands on yuan, or you know, he wants to get his hands on dollars. You know, these are
maybe cryptocurrencies.
The convertible currencies.
Use of cryptocurrencies shot up on February 24th.
Well, maybe, but you know, it's hard still to transact in anything, you know, significant with crypto. And I think OFAC is coming after crypto in the end. If crypto is going to be used to break sanctions, crypto will feel the weight of Western financial sanctions as well.
All right. What about gold? You mentioned gold there. What's the possibility that the Russian ruble becomes, well, even at least de facto, backed by gold now?
Well, you know, it doesn't really it doesn't resolve the underlying problem that even if you can transact, even if it's legal to transact with Russia and trade with Russia, people do not want to. People do not want to take the ethical risk of transacting with Putin's Russia because of what he's done in Ukraine.
Well, it's been good talking to you. Thanks so much, Timothy.
My pleasure. Cheers.
Another asset seen as an alternative medium of international exchange to the dollar is cryptocurrency. Many governments are worried the digital coin could provide a hidden route for sanctioned Russians to preserve their wealth. The virtual money is unregulated and it bypasses the international banking system, which, of course, is key to enforcing those sanctions. And the exchanges have come under pressure to address violation concerns. They've resisted several calls to block Russian users as a whole and are not yet legally obliged to do so. However, major cryptocurrency exchanges like Binance say they will comply with sanctions and abide by the law. But there are thousands of smaller, less strict exchanges which could step in and allow the transactions. The cryptocurrency research firm Kaiko says the average trade size of Bitcoin ruble transaction hit a 10-month high on February 24th when Russia invaded Ukraine. It's estimated more than 17 million Russians, or 12% of the population, invest in cryptocurrency. Russia ranked 18th worldwide in terms of cryptocurrency adoption. It had the third largest share of overseas transfers after Turkey and Ukraine. Russian entities that are under sanctions have been accused of using ransomware attacks for revenues. The blockchain tracking firm Chainalysis says around 74% of that income, or $400 million, went to entities that could be affiliated with Russia last year. Well, joining me now is Kaya Parv, the Chief Investment Officer at Credilink.ai, an artificial intelligence-enabled credit asset management company. She joins me from Singapore. Good to have you with us. So, Kaya, can cryptocurrencies provide an alternative to the US dollar, do you think?
At this point, decentralized cryptocurrencies definitely do not provide an alternative for US dollar. US dollar is still backed by the world's most largest and powerful economy, as well as the trade and financial flows. Crypto does not provide such backing at this point. Having said that, digitalized currencies and perhaps fiat-backed crypto could replace USD to some extent. And we have seen some tests already rolled out in China, whereby the PBOC has issued digitalized yuan that has been injected into digital wallets. The use case for such money could make sense in the event of natural disaster or even with the current Ukrainian crisis.
Or can it go any distance in helping countries like Russia to evade sanctions?
I think it's difficult to use crypto to evade sanctions because if we look at the size of Russian economy, it's currently about 1.7 trillion, whereas the entire market capitalization of crypto is 1.8 trillion. So crypto does not have the capacity or the depth to allow Russia to evade sanctions.
And but maybe not Russia's all the sanctions. Can it be helpful? I mean, obviously, as you pointed out, the volume there simply doesn't cover all of Russia's needs, but can it go some length?
To some extent, I would say yes. And if we look at Russia's decision to allow crypto transactions earlier this year, although there was a lot of debate around banning crypto, we could insinuate that perhaps the decision was influenced by the Ukrainian invasion. And we can't rule out maybe there was some sort of tip-off to oligarch close to Putin that you may want to move some of your assets to crypto markets.
What can governments do to monitor activities with cryptocurrency they consider to be illegal?
It's a bit tricky to monitor. I mean, of course, governments can do what they always do, which is impose more regulation, be it in the form of transaction reporting or transaction or taxation or even straight out banning. But generally, the marketplaces where crypto is traded are already regulated one way or the other, meaning that those marketplaces operate in heavily regulated jurisdictions such as the US or the EU. And the endpoints are regulated, meaning if you want to do crypto transactions, you have to use a major currency such as the euro or the USD against it.
All right. We saw a huge uptick in crypto transactions on February the 24th from Russia. What are people using it for if, as you said, it's kind of limited in terms of how far it can go to help with sanctions evasion?
I think we could be seeing the first real use case for crypto with this Ukrainian crisis, as a lot of individuals as well as entities are moving some of their money and some of their assets into crypto. So crypto could be proved to be a store of wealth at this point in time, although we can't really do any actual transactions in crypto yet.
So this could trigger individuals, just average savers, increasingly looking towards cryptocurrency, not just sanctioned oligarchs.
I would say so. And looking at the comments coming from, let's say, Coinbase and some of the other markets, they have said pretty straightforwardly they are not going to ban Russian individuals doing transactions on their markets because they feel they can't penalize individuals. And I would agree with that. But having said that, limited access to the endpoints, let's say the dollar and the euro, definitely puts a bit of halt on entering crypto for regular Russians.
All right, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much, Kaya.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for this week. But remember, you can get in touch with us via Twitter. Use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. There's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Sami Zeidan from the whole team here. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.